Host Pat, coming at you from, once again, sunny Tampa, Florida. Survived a few days of chaos there with the hurricane, but rest assured, house is good, family's good, pets are good. Everything's great from that end, so glad to go through that. Joined with me is my co-host, Bruno. Bruno, how are we doing?
Absolutely fantastic, mate, and very happy to hear that all is good with you.
Yeah, definitely good, definitely good. A little scary, but we made it through, so all good. All sunny skies now. And joined with one of our regular guests, Bobby Manzi. Bobby, how are we doing?
Yeah, I'm okay. I think anything stronger than okay is probably not true. But most importantly, I'm glad you're well in Florida.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. I really appreciate those words, guys. And I'd be doing better if we had something other than a zero in the win column for our beloved Crystal Palace. But unfortunately, we're here to report on some more losses. Going back to right before the break, when we went up against Liverpool, somewhat heartfelt contest, some changes by Glasner that seemed to be well received and well asked for by a lot of Palace supporters. But again, the result was still the same, a 1-0 loss to the Reds at Selhurst Park. So, Bruno, what were your takeaways from any of that match? Anything of note?
I was really lucky to be with a couple of the Palace Way lads in the VIP boxes, which was pretty amazing for that game. And I was joined by the guys from Eagle Eye Football and the guys from Back of the Nest. And all of us just felt this overwhelming frustration at the way we were playing. I think that first half was possibly worse than the Manchester United first half. We looked quite woeful, and I don't think things have picked up since then, but we'll get on to that. We had a change of shape in the second half, and we looked a lot better. We were probably the better side in that second half as well. So I think my main takeaway from Liverpool was, we clearly don't know what our best system is. And that lays on sort of Oliver Glasner's shoulders in that, you know, we've made a stupid amount of halftime substitutions this season already. It's already more than the amount we made for the entirety of last season, and we're in October. Adam Wharton was having a woeful game because he wasn't fit. That's an issue that's been sort of spoken about a lot this week. Dom Smith did a really good article on it. But yeah, I mean, we've got enough quality when the system clicks with those players, and when we adapt to change the opposition. I think the issue is more in that case, and in many cases this season, we're not starting with the right 11, and we can't seem to get ahead of everyone else. We're always sort of chasing our own tail, sort of tactically.
Yeah, I think there's a bit of a broken record, as we know, the issue of that right half space and not having a player that seems comfortable being creative in that area. With Liverpool, we went with Ismaila Sarr. Let me do that one again. In Liverpool, we went with Ismaila Sarr playing in that right half space, and he's much more of a finisher, someone that finishes final balls than someone that creates opportunities for others. I think his passing in the first half of that match was in the 50s, something like 55%. It's just not something that we need from that position. It really leaves Eze to do a lot of work, and it leaves Eze to kind of have that old Zaha tendency of do too much and try and push too hard and try and take too many people on in inopportune times. And it just led to a very lopsided look. And I definitely agree. I think we looked a lot better in the second half, maybe a bit unlucky there, but I'll echo your words. I think that we have a lot of tools. We have a lot of pieces. There's an old adage that says a camel is a horse by committee. And we look a lot more like a camel right now than we do a horse. We just look like a bunch of pieces, but no real cohesion and no real final product. So, Bobby, what are your takeaways from this before we segue into the Forest match?
I just thought it was a story of Ibrahim Eze not being good enough again, quite frankly. I think he let himself down against Liverpool, and I think he let the fans down. I mean, chances that he should just be scoring. Quite frankly, it was the same against Manchester United. I thought the first half, there were issues in the first half. But I actually thought Palace did all right to stand strong defensively, which you would take as a positive. I think in the second half, Palace were, as Bruno said, probably, I wouldn't go as far and say the better side, but they had the better chances. And they were matching Liverpool at times. Probably should have walked away with a point. And just the story of missed opportunities again, quite frankly. And I just think it's become a bit of a theme of the season. I think whenever Palace get into the opposition box, they don't take the chances, but it's very rare they're getting into the opposition box, and the chances they are getting are shots from outside the box. I think back to the goal against Chelsea to get a point. That was an Eberechi-Eze wonder goal from outside the box. I think about the good chances Palace had in Nottingham yesterday. They were all shots from outside the box, looking for spectacular efforts all the time. The reality is that Palace have got nobody to break down the opposition back line, and it's a really worrying theme for anyone involved in the football club, and it's a symptom that will take you into the championship, I'm afraid.
Yeah, to that point with Eze, if you look at kind of the metrics behind how he's playing this season, do they corroborate what you're saying? They absolutely do. And, full caveat, he's one of my favorite players. I absolutely love him as a human being. I love him as a player. He's done some great things for us. If you look at his XG factors for a per 90 basis this season, he's in the upper third of attacking midfielders. I think he's in the 67th percentile or something like that in terms of generating XG. But in terms of his goals minus his XG, which it looks at how often is he scoring when he, quote, should be scoring, he's in the sixth,
I would say it's about minus
it's,
four, is
yes,
it?
and he's in the sixth percentile. So he's one of the worst number 10s in the entire Premier League this season in regards to finishing chances that he should be finishing.
I would also the one thing I would say in defense of Eze is I don't think the role he's playing is necessarily suiting him, because he's almost like a he's been obviously at Forest on Monday. He played as like the second striker, if you like. But that's debatable for me whether he actually fulfilled that role, because a lot of the time he was much deeper anyway. But in the other games, he plays that left-sided 10 role, which is a bit of a hybrid between a winger and a 10. And it just doesn't really feel a natural fit for him. I think he's much better as a sole 10 with two midfielders behind him, like two holding midfielders, if you like. He has the 10 and wingers either side. I think he was okay there last season because you had players doubling up on Elise essentially because of how murderous he was to people's teams, and it was just giving Eze that bit more space. But now he's the only real focal point in attack. It's just easy to neutralise him in games.
Yeah, I mean, I think something that we're really losing in our sort of five at the back setup is numbers in midfield for like players to pass to. Weirdly, there's very little interplay. I think a lot of our attacks at the moment rely on a player receiving the ball in a bit of space, running forward, and then just putting a ball into the box. It's quite unsophisticated in terms of build up. And the problem is we don't really have wing backs who can take a player on. So if there's someone in front of them, which there is like 98% of the time, they're just going to end up passing sideways into this sort of midfield where we don't have the numbers all backwards. Instead of triangles, this is something that like people kind of talk about. It gets maybe a bit overly technical or clowned on, but like you need triangles in football generally of players to sort of form good passing movements because it just it's ideal in terms of having an extra man and just moving yourself up the pitch through possession. And with our current formation, we don't really get that unless you sort of move to create a localized sort of overload of players. Last season, we get that.
To get the triangles, you're relying on the central midfielders always being involved and the fullbacks always being involved.
Yeah, we're not having that because our best midfielders are injured and our wing backs are incapable of taking a player on, but we don't have localized overloads anymore. Last season, we had Nathaniel Clyne on the right-hand side supporting Munoz both defensively and offensively. That was huge for us. Also supported Elise. You cr got these three players, sometimes even four players on that side against one wing back on the counter-attack, and that was devastating. With Elise, Eze, Mateta, that three was deadly because they were, well, Elise and Eze were such similar players that everyone was focusing on them, both sort of not equally skilled at specific things, but they're similar. And it created space for Mateta because that's what he thrives on, is running in behind. surprisingly enough. I think Eddie Nketiah would have had a similar return to JP last season if he'd had Olise there, you know, like.
I spoke to someone quite influential after the game yesterday. Not involved at Palace, but a bit influential in the game, should I say? And they said to me that they're incapable of scoring and they've got no confidence in defence, even at centre back, which I thought was quite worrying, considering we all think that the centre halves have been probably the best part of Palace's team this season. And when you've got neutral arbiters saying that Palace don't look very confident at the centre of defence, I would say that is very, very worrying.
I mean, the defense, I think, is possibly the most excusable aspect of our team solely because of the amount of change it's had. We've lost the player that was our captain for our best run last season. Mark Gay also didn't play in that run. So effectively, our defense has entirely changed from the winning record.
On Monday, you saw Maxent Lacroix, centre of the back three. So it's changing around quite a lot. But it just doesn't look cohesive. Yes, there's good individuals in there. Yes, there's good challenges. Yes, we're only conceding one goal a game. But I just, like you say with Klein last year, there's no one to really, we've not been carrying that ball from the defence. Munoz hasn't been getting up the pitch. And everything just looks so disjointed from back to front that there's no transitions from defence to attack.
Well, you need players who can carry the ball if in those transitions, and unfortunately, we only have one player capable of that, and that's Eze, and he's not particularly quick. Like for a side that defends.
But it was like yesterday, against Forest yesterday, Chalobah carried the ball once, and it was almost the most threatening we'd look. He carried the ball from centre half into midfield. I was like, oh wow, they've done something. They've progressed. They've got forwards. And all right, the move broke down, but it just lacks someone to just take that ball with a bit of confidence and go. And all right, if you get dispossessed, whatever it happens, it's football. But there's no confidence to take a player on. There's no confidence carrying the ball up the pitch, and it all just looks
Yeah.
aimless. Is the word I keep
Yeah,
coming back
I
to.
completely agree with you there. I think the way we're set up is quite strange, you know. This season we've seen a lot of long balls when we don't have a tall player up front, or JP's not winning headers or aerial duels in general. We've seen a lot of sort of Dean Henderson punting it rather than playing short. We've seen a real reluctance to take players on. Glasner seems to consistently say that that's not tactical. Like it's a mental thing. He's focused a lot on sort of the mentality of his players and confidence. I don't think that's the only reason. I think that's sort of covering for sort of papering over some cracks. I think one of the main things for me that have been kind of the defining issue of our season past the transfer window is player fitness. You know, Mateta came back, Wharton came back, neither of them were fit. I'd argue, well, neither of them still are, but especially Wharton, who is basically playing through a problem that requires surgery to fix, based off Oliver Glasner's comments. And given that he's been evaluated twice now by England and sent back both times.
But he wasn't evaluated the second time by England.
Okay.
He didn't report to camp. Palace did things instead. He then was assessed by a like a professional clinic in London. And when it was eventually determined that he would need surgery, because I remember telling you once I found it out that he needed surgery, that was what the conclusion they had come to. And I think it's just a real concern personally. I think it's a concern that Palace are taking a risk on a player that could stand to make them upwards of £80 million in the next 2 years because they haven't got enough depth. I think he should be having the surgery now, because number one, he's not looking very good in midfield anyway. And number two, you're just going to make it a hell of a lot worse. And when it comes to the running, when you're going to need him the most, will he be fit? Or has it been dragged out too long that it's been made worse? You're going to take a longer time to recover and still injured,
Yeah,
essentially.
it reminds me of that Rashford injury back in the some of the Euros when he sort of played through a lot of pain to be able to play for his country, then had surgery and was, to put it frankly, quite woeful for the entirety of the 2021 season.
And the issue I've got with it as well is I know other facts of another player who's got a similar injury in the squad. And it's not been reported, and they're still playing quite often. And I just find it a huge concern that there is this amount of players in the red zone, and because Palace have got a paper thin squad, that they're having to be enforced to playing them. I mean, it's like I keep using this phrase, but everything that's going on at the club at the minute is an absolute recipe for disaster. Things are all over the shop in training. Things are not good, and this is why when I keep getting very frustrated with any time I mention the prospect of relegation, that you get slaughtered maybe because you're a young journalist or you're a journalist and you've never been there during the tough days, and that you're just there to cover the club. This is why it's awfully frustrating, because there's a hell of a lot going on that people don't know about, and I would say that things don't look like they're in a good position at the moment, and I'd struggle to see a world where Oliver Glasner makes it to the next international break.
Let's sort of break down a couple of those things. I think you've spoken a lot about sort of problems behind the scenes. Obviously, we can't get into too much detail always, but there are multiple factors at play here. Pat, do you have any sort of specific things you'd like to discuss?
In terms of, I want to bring up something that you said, where you mentioned that we're kind of booting the ball a lot longer and playing it a bunch, overhead when we don't really have the ability to win those aerial duels up front. So if we just kind of step back and look at why that's happening, let's go to last spring and let's look at what made this formation, this 3-4-2-1, successful. With the wing backs, it wasn't really about production for them, right? Mitchell wasn't getting a ton of goals and assists, neither was Munoz. But their positioning, their threat of holding that width was something that the defenses had to honor. It kept them honest, and it allowed us to kind of play in those half spaces and make those interchanges with Eze, with Elise, with Mateta. And then we also had Wharton, of course, playing those balls kind of through and being progressive in his ability to play those passes. Well, now we don't have anybody in that right half space that can handle that creative workload. We don't have anybody to do that. So our choices were really to expect our wing backs, who aren't the most creative and involved with goals, to rapidly step up. To Mitchell's credit, he's trying. His numbers in terms of volume are much higher. In terms of efficiency, they're not so great. And the other option would be, of course, to try and find somebody to play in that space, which we really haven't been doing. So we kind of go to this down the rung, plan B, plan C, plan D, and we get to these long balls that we have to play forward. Now, in that Forest match last night on Monday, we started to see some of the kind of Anderson style passes of trying to progress on the ground, bypassing the midfield and getting them up to the feet of Eze, getting them up to the feet of Nketiah. And there was some kind of bright spots with there too, but it just seemed like once they got it and they turned, there was nobody there to go at and try and attack the box. And it just goes back to square one again, where there's just not enough threats and not enough advantageous positions for us to get into.
So tactically, I guess that's kind of like the first, like most visible kind of issue from a Crystal Palace perspective. But if we sort of move deeper from into like a club level, I guess I'm not going to talk about the transfer window because we've spoken about that plenty on this podcast. We've spoken about not replacing Elise. We've spoken about, was it really a cohesive plan? Was Zoggy Friedman that?
I just think it is important to say that on the transfer window, that I've seen a lot of criticism of the board, and I'm by no means a messenger of the board. I'm by no means coming on here to stick up the board. But Oliver Glasner was a backer of this plan. Oliver Glasner was an advocate for keeping a small squad. Yes, he wanted another left wing back, but as far as he's concerned, the players he got were the players he wanted, and that was Palace's business done, other than not getting a fullback.
Albeit about 3 weeks to 4 weeks later than he.
Glasner's sole issue was how late the business had been done, but he got, at the end of the day, he got the players he wants. And the fact that there's no natural Elise replacement in the side, yes, all right, you can say, well, the club should have saw it anyway and got the player or whatever. But at the end of the day, the manager was happy with the squad of players he was given. Therefore, he cannot now say, I wasn't backed, because he was backed. They went and got the players he wanted. They recruited the profiles he asked for, and he said he was happy with the players he's got. So, yes, I would probably say it's maybe 60-40 on terms of accountability, Glasner being the 60. But I don't think anyone can just use this as a method to say, oh, parish out, parish this, whatever, because a lot of the butt lands with Oliver Glasner.
Yeah, I mean, the transfer window is kind of where a lot of my faith in Oliver Glasner actually declined, weirdly. Just because of the fact that the board had been so impressed with his vision for a post-Elise Crystal Palace when he got the job. Personally, that vision doesn't seem to be coming to fruition. So
No, I have to say this. I was massively impressed with it. I liked it. I thought recruiting different profiles, giving yourself lots of options. I thought that was quite a good plan in theory. But yeah, it's just worked out to be the polar opposite.
I think we've kind of forced ourselves into a weird hole because we've signed so many centre backs and we really look like we need an extra man in midfield, whether that's Eze in that, well, yeah, Eze in that 10 role basically with an extra winger. Except now we've got like
We
centre backs
basically
and no
miss.
wingers.
We essentially miss Jordan Ayew,
No, no,
because
no.
no, we do. Hang on, let me make the point. Because if you want to change to a 4-3-3 now, in theory you've got Sarr on the right. You have nobody on the left. There's no options. There's no Palace at the moment need a winger who can
You
work
could
hard,
play.
and grinds hard to create chances. And then you can change that 4-3-3 because you could have Sarr on the right and Ayew on the left. Now, instead, if you want to change to a 4-3-3, you're going to be relying on either Jeffrey Schlupp or a young kid who no one knows how good he's going to be in Ashraq Benoni.
I think you need to. We need to look at formations as more fluid than just on paper. I don't think a 4-3-3 would be our best shape for us to move forward with, but I have nothing wrong with putting Eze at left wing if he's not really playing left wing, if he's being inverted and playing on the left half space. But the problem is that we,
But
and
that
what, again,
brings us whole back to that same issue of
we
there's
read
no
through this.
balance in the side again.
The problem is that if we have to rely on Mitchell, and that's what we really did with Vieira, if you remember, when Zaha was kind of playing in that left half space and he scored a lot of goals, he got closer to goal. We rolled Mitchell up and he played as a de facto left winger whenever we had possession. And that shape that we attacked in was at 3-2-5 or the 2-3-5, depending on what happened with the right back and Ward. Normally he tucked in and became a 3, a 2, and a 5 across the front. That could happen with Eze easily, but it's just Mitchell again. You know, he hasn't really shown that he can be that efficient in his attack. And to your point with Glasner, I've been in the world of professional sports. I've been in dugouts with head coaches, managers. In baseball, we call them managers, just like your football also. And I'm not saying this is the case because I don't know the man and I don't know what goes on behind closed doors, but I am saying we absolutely cannot rule out Glasner just trying to be glass half full and say, hey, I'm happy with what we got. This is fine. We don't need a big squad. I can do this. Because he knew the writing on the wall was that he wasn't going to get the guys he wanted if he put his foot down and demanded the guys. We can't refute that unless someone has further evidence than me. You guys are a little more in the know of that stuff than I am and tell me, hey, you're wrong, and I'll gladly stop talking. But I've been in those situations where you get the talk from up top, you get the talk from your bosses that this is how it's going to be. And instead of just butting heads and fighting with it, you accept it, you have a positive spin on it, and you say, that's fine, I can make do with this.
Well, I think Glasner was the one who gave the talk. I don't think the bosses were the one necessarily leading that conversation at first. I think the plan on how to replace Michael Olise came from Oliver Glasner, and Dougie Freeman, Ian Moody, and Steve Parish executed it.
Although I don't think when Oliver Glasner said the rough player of he wanted, he went up there and said, I want Eddie Nketiah and Ismaila Sarr. Those are names that have been on our radar for
But
years.
there were names put forward to him
That's my point.
from what Oliver Glasner described. If you didn't want those players, if you're a strong leader, you turn around and say, no, they don't suit what I'm trying to do here. He's accepted those players. Eddie Nketiah, that had been on the wall for a couple of weeks, didn't just come out of nowhere. Palace didn't just hijack the move to Forest. Yes, he was on his way to Forest, but Palace had been plotting to move for him for a while. So this had been an internal policy. This had been an internal plan of players that they were going to bring in.
I mean,
Glasner had to be stronger.
if we think about like ways of making that sort of idea of a 4-2-3-1 work. Is it possible that, I mean, it would leave us weak on the bench striking wise. We could technically deploy a front three of Nketiah on the left, kind of like how we did with Edouard, Mateta up top, Sarr on the right, Eze in the middle. It's not ideal, but you know, we saw
Rather than play Schlupp, I'd
Nketiah's
rather
best
play.
moments yesterday came off the left, like that little.
I'd rather see Schlupp on the left. I'd rather than play a left-sided player on the left. I'm very fed up with seeing the pragmatism of trying to force players into position where they're not good enough in. We've seen it with Palace this season. We saw it with England at the Euros. Frankly, play players in their position, play a system where it's suited to the players you've got. Otherwise, it ends in tears. It's the what I've come to with football at the moment. I'm just fed up of people trying to force players into positions they were
If
not good
we're
enough to play.
talking Eze in the hole as a 10, with his tendency to want to shift over to the left half space, it probably would be best if we had a left-footed winger on that left side that wanted to kind of get chalk on his boots and hug the touchline. Just because if we had a right-sided one, he'd want to cut in and it would kind of create that muddled mess between him and Eze. But yeah, I mean, we're stuck for guys like that. And if we don't want to look at a back four per se, and we want to switch the shape. That's something that, from my opinion, I think from all of us that watched the match last night, we saw that. You know, we saw a different form of three of the back, five of the back, whatever you wanted to call it. For me, it was a very clear 5-3-2 mid-low block. You know, kind of a little more low than I would like to be against Forest, and then it turned into that 3-5-1-1 where Eze floated right behind Nketiah as that second striker. The problem with that, of course, as he drifted left, Kamada wanted to push up from that left center mid position, and nobody was really pushing up from the right center mid. Will Hughes does his best at that, but that's not what he's there for. He's not that type of player. Like you just said, we can't be pigeonholing these guys to play roles that they're not best for. If Will Hughes is playing roles where he's breaking up play and winning balls back and trying to get forward afterwards with a quick pass, I'm all for it. But when he starts drifting wide right, which he did a lot last night, and he starts trying to cover the right half space, it's just not going to work. You know, you don't need to. Of course not. He never really was. Maybe going back to his Derby days, but I mean, that was a long time ago. So.
Yeah, he was young and he was a bit quicker. He's lost a couple of yards. My biggest concern last night actually was, yes, Palace had chances. Yes, they hit the post and they all came outside from the box, and we've already done that. But Forest could have easily have won that game 4-0. Quite easily have won that game 4-0. Chris Wood could have had a hat trick. He missed countless chances. Anderson, who was absolutely excellent last night. I mean, £35 million is a hell of a lot of money, but what a buy. I was so impressed. He had an excellent chance. The Forest had really, really good high quality chances, the kind of chances that Palace don't have. And they really should have been out of sight. So that almost tells you about the defence being a problem last night as well. Because if Forest took their chances, Palace would have been blown away.
Yeah, I mean, Forest, their expected goals on target, which is the post shot model that's married to the pre shot model of just regular XG. So it's not looking at every shot from that space on the pitch, but it's looking at the shots that are on frame of goal. Their post shot model, their XGOT was 1.9, something like that. So despite Henderson's error, if you want to call it that, he still had a great performance because he saved a lot more than he should have let in. To the point of Palace, this goes on.
But it's like the one that wasn't on target, right? Chris Wood had a header from like 2 yards out that he put
Right,
wide.
right.
It's
But they're, yeah.
any striker should be scoring
Yeah,
it. I mean, there were so many good chances that they had,
100%.
and I find it so concerning. I don't think Forest were even that good, and that's probably why I find it even more concerning. I don't even think I think the thought Glasner's quote post match was quite uninfusing as well. He said about that they were coming to Nottingham. They didn't expect to play their best football. It's just not possible. The plan was to be compact, fight, and work on creating moments. I mean, how negative is that? You have to go into every game thinking you can play your best football, even if things aren't working out for you quite now. And I think he's spoken a lot about the mentality of the group being low. I mean, when you're putting messages out like that, then yeah, the messages are going to be low. Yes, the confidence is going to be low. I struggle to come up with the words really, because I don't quite get what's going on. It's just an absolute mess.
Yeah, and those, to you know, going back to that XGOT, and it's to a point that this confidence levels are low. last year when we were flying last spring going into the end of the season, our XG to our XGOT, so our pre-shot model to our post-shot was relatively the same. It was 1.63 to 1.62, so almost exactly the same. We were scoring on, we were putting balls on frame that we were supposed to, and we were scoring at a clip and creating chances like we should have been. This year, our MPXG per 90 is only 1.05, which is not good, but our XGOT is 0.8. So we're 20% less than what it should be. And that 100% goes to what you're talking about. The confidence just isn't there. Even when we're getting good opportunities, which is far less than it was last season, but even when we are getting good opportunities, we're not putting the ball on frame of goal, or we're putting it right to the center of goal into the keeper's hands and not trying to place it in the corner and just making these misses. So the chances that we are getting, few and far between, we're not being clinical enough with them. And like you said, it's a recipe for disaster. I think that's a great, great phrase to use.
I say I don't get. I mean, don't get the on the pitch stuff because it just shouldn't be this negative. It shouldn't be this bad. Yes, there's, like I've already said, stuff going on behind it. So I do get it. I don't get it was probably the wrong phrase to use, but it's just baffling when you sit here and consider everything, how bad it's actually got from the optimism going into the season. It's concerning. I think concerning was probably the word I was looking for. At the moment, I don't see a space where Palace survive. I really don't, because they've not. Even if you sack Oliver Glasner and bring in David Moyes, you've not got players to play David Moyes football. There's no depth there. There's no numbers there. There's no wingers there. I think this is the closest Palace have ever been to going down, and I do think it's going to be a very close run thing. I think if they get to January and they're still in the battle, then they're going to have to spend next summer's budget, so that's going to be problems for next season as well. I just think it's very messy at the moment, very, very messy. Wolves is absolutely huge. I mean, one of the biggest games of the season. We're not even 10 games into it. It's bleak.
Now, looking ahead to those three matches before this next international window, we have Spurs at home this upcoming weekend, away to Wolves, and home to Fulham after that. What chain of results would lead to Glasner's departure, in your opinion? Is it just all three of them being losses, or is there any other scenario where you think that it just might not be enough? Bruno, I'll go to you first.
I think anything less than 4 points from those games sees him definitely gone. Because, a win at Tottenham will see him sacked if he then loses to Wolves and Fulham. A loss at Tottenham and then getting knocked out of the EFL Cup by Villa probably sees him get sacked before Wolves, to be honest. I don't think we should sack him at all, personally, because. But, he's made sure a judgment mistake in the general sort of shape of the squad and his role in that. And there's no one better. We've got the players that can play his system. We just need to, there's just something missing. I don't know what to say.
But if there's something missing, what do you do? Do you go and sign Brian Kent on a free transfer? What is there you can do? Because the thing's missing is the personnel, and he's not adapting to that personnel. So sometimes you need a change of ideas.
Why don't we play two number 10s in the two number 10 roles? Why don't everyone's talking about how he's being too stubborn and playing a 3-4-2-1. We haven't seen that same 3-4-2-1 all season since Chelsea, which Chelsea, one of the hottest teams in England right now, and we held them to a draw. You can say it was a lucky, impressive outside the box goal by Eze, but it was one of our most complete performances, especially that second half. And Kamada was playing in the right attacking mid position, and we had balance in the squad, and he looked
Yeah,
pretty
but you
damn
had the
good.
core and Walton in midfield, so that there's your midfield balance solved.
Absolutely. But my point is that I keep hearing these murmurs of we're not doing the 3-4-2-1, we're being too stubborn. He's being too stubborn. We haven't seen it. Just play Eze and Kamada up there. And if you want to live and die with Kamada at that point, I'll eat crow. But I want to see it at some point.
I think the stubbornness probably comes from sticking with a back three when it's not working with the wing backs and there's no whips. And I don't think the attacking version matters with it, because to attack effectively in that formation, you're relying on the whip from the wing backs.
We didn't really. It's like they're holding the width, yes, but not in terms of creating. We saw it last season. We saw it last season. We didn't create from the width. We created from the threat of width. And we could do that if we had two number 10s. I just want to see it. That's all. Yeah, and whether or not Glasner does revert back to that 3-4-2-1 with those 10s, and whether or not he gives himself enough time, he may be behind the eight ball too much. So, Bobby, what are your thoughts? Where are you thinking with him? Is he gonna get a longer leash, or is he gonna be really under scrutiny these next two, three matches? How much do you think his job may be in jeopardy?
Yeah, so I think if Palace fail to win one of the next two league games, I don't think he makes it to Fulham personally. I think the cup game's largely irrelevant for his future. I mean, I think he's still will still throw everything at it because that's the kind of manager he is. He likes the cup competitions. Still got that ambition about him, but yeah, I think failure to win one of not failure to win failure to yeah no I'm gonna stick that failure to win one of Tottenham or Fulham will see him sacked, because quite frankly, no manager can go 10 games without a win at the start of the season and not expect to lose their job.
It's very hard to refute that. When you look at it from that lens, it's a tough thing to refute.
And in terms of replacements, I think we're looking at David Moyes. I don't think it'll be Graham Potter personally. I think there would be a want from the club to bring Gareth Southgate in, but it's whether he would be prepared to curtail his year-long break, which I doubt he would. I have no information on that at all, but just from the kind of guy he is. Obviously, coming out of a really testing, what, 4 or 5 years as England? No, more than that, isn't it? Six, at least 6 years as England boss. I think he'll want to take that break. So yeah, I don't think the candidates are necessarily great. I don't think David Moyes would be a bad appointment, actually, personally. But it's just, I keep using the same phrases, words, but it's just bleak. I feel quite low at the moment with it. I think a lot of people feel quite low at the moment with it. I think fans feel low. I think there's people within the club that feel low. I think the players feel very low, and that's always a concern. I try to be as positive as possible, but in the current climate, there's not much to be positive about.
Yeah, and unfortunately, you're putting the nail on the head with a lot of that there. But as we do here, we do want to try to keep things positive. There isn't a lot of good things to talk about right now. Objectively, we have to call it like it is, and unfortunately, that's going to ring true. But Bruno, I know that you're much in tune with the academy at Crystal Palace, and one of the bright spots in that match happened in the 88th minute when we had a certain academy player being subbed on and was able to show a little bit of what people are getting so excited about when they see him play. So I'll let you take the floor and you can talk.
Ashraf Benoni is just such a fun player to watch. He was really unlucky last season to have an injury at the start of it that kept him out until about December. But then he came into the 18s. He was older for that group, and he was immediately one of the best players in that group. Stepped up to the 21s this season. Really impressed Oliver Glasner. Was brilliant in preseason. Scored a goal against Premier League opposition in Wolves. He's, just as pure of a fast and tricky winger as you can get. Like, all he wants to do is get the ball, take a man on, and cross or shoot. And he does it well. And we saw glimpses of that in his little cameo last night. I was rewatching his performance just now, and he's not scared. He was up against Ola Aina, and he wins a corner off him, and he's pulling out all the tricks. He's got a lot to learn in terms of sort of pacing and positioning, and he's for the 21s in particular been probably more influential off the right hand side than the left, just because he's less predictable that way, because he always wants to cut inside when he's on the left. But Glasner seems to like him kind of the most out of the youth prospects he's got at his disposal at the moment, at least relative to the players that we need. He seems the most likely to get game time given the state of our attacking line. And honestly, Given the fact he really didn't look out of place when he came on, why not give him more minutes? Because he's got bundles of ability. He's got a lot to learn, sure, but in terms of his sheer traits as a player, he is fast, skillful, and he knows where the goal is. And if there's anything we need, it's someone with that unpredictability that Ashraf Benoni has, and someone who can carry the ball forward and drive us in those transitions and on the counter attack. That's Ashraf Benoni.
And you're echoing a lot of things that I was saying before we started recording here with Bobby. The thing that I said was, it was a small cameo, it was a small little bit of playing time for him, but the moment did not seem too big for him. You can kind of see that intangible quality in a player, in a young player, when they step on the pitch, and he looked ready. He looked like nothing was going to intimidate him. He dropped a shoulder on trying to make a run there. Was brought out shades of a young Wilf, as we were saying earlier. So there's definitely a bright spot there. And as we talked about before, this is a smaller squad, and whether it was Glasner's idea or whether it was Glasner rolling with the punches, he agreed to it. And if we are going to agree to that, and he is going to have a small squad, then why not use this academy that we've been trying to build up? We've been hearing for years that we just got to be patient with it, and I agree we do. These things don't get made overnight, but we're in a moment where, I hate to say it, it can't get much worse from an attacking output standpoint. So what better time to maybe, blood some youth and get their beaks wet, get their feet wet a little bit playing and seeing what they got. I mean, I was impressed enough that I could see it, and I don't see many other people on that bench that are going to step up and try these things. So I'm all for it.
Yeah, he's just sorry. Yeah,
No, I
Bobby,
was
you
just going to say,
speak.
just coming in on that, I think you guys have done it really good justice. I was really proud of Asher last night. I thought he'd come on. He did himself and his family a really good service. I just think that he's a very good lad, is the way I would put it. Obviously, he's had injuries in his youth career, which haven't been conducive, but no one deserves it more than him. I mean, he's so driven, he's so focused on his football. And really, truly, it's what he lives for. Like so many of us, football is his passion. But he's just so driven, so focused to get to that end goal of being a Crystal Palace player. And I just think it's remarkable, really. I just think for me, him and probably Joe Whitworth are those two top lads in that academy that are just remarkable human beings, talented footballers, and have got a hell of a lot to give in the game.
Yeah, and that's what supporting this club really is all about when it comes down to it. We'd like us to win more. We'd certainly like us not to be in the relegation spot or get relegated to the championship, but we're not glory hunters. Me certainly, I didn't have any local ties. I didn't have any reason to support Palace. I'm a kid from New York to move down to Florida. And what I fell in love with this club was the way that it supported its community, the way that it took care of its own, the way that it had such pride in being from the area that they're from and embracing that culture. And I think bringing these kids up from the academy is just the perfect representation of that. So when it does get down, when we do get negative, when the results aren't there, it's so easy to immediately just kind of hit the panic button and be toxic and be negative. But I think if we step back and look at the big picture of what we're doing for the community and what we're doing for kids like Asher and kids like Whitworth, I think there's still a lot to be proud of with this club. That being said, can we please win some matches in the next couple of weeks?
Talking about positives, actually, I have managed to come up with a positive. And it's how well Palace are doing in the WSL. It was a rough start to life in the WSL, two huge defeats, but then an away win at Leicester, a really good performance against Brighton, which, quite frankly, missed chances, were unlucky not to take at least a point from that game. And then an excellent performance away at Liverpool, where Palace were, for large parts, the better side on Sunday. Probably deserved all 3 points, but walked away with a point against the established, talented WSL outfit with a remarkable manager. Next up is City at home after the international break on the 3rd. And they're in a really good position at the minute. 8th in the WSL, 11 on points with Tottenham, and don't really look like a side that are going down, and only look like a side that are getting better. So I do think that's one cause to be super positive for Palace fans.
And I love it. I love it. There you have it, dear listener. As you see, we are so positive with our outlook, as you can see here. So, as always, I appreciate you all listening. Bruno, I'm just going to throw it to you for any final words, anything you want to put a bow on, wrap up before we sign off.
Just that, we all support the same football club. Bobby touched on it earlier. We're all fans. It's tough for us all when we're going through a rough patch. Football isn't everything. There's more to life than football. This is such a weird thing coming from me because I tend to sort of live and die by Palace's results, right? But like, just take a breather from it all. I found the international break so fucking cathartic. The only time I had to think about football was when I was on TalkSport for my radio debut. Check that one out. But with Paul Ross, I think that was like about a week ago now. But aside from that little plug, just stay calm, stay cool. We all love Crystal Palace. It always gets better. I'm praying it does this time too.
Yeah, I'd coming in on that. I found Twitter a really difficult space to be in, over the past week or so, to the point I've now deleted the app and I turn my comments off and I just go onto Twitter on the Mac to now tweet work stuff, because I kind of bother with it. I think that fans, if you like, on Twitter don't necessarily represent a Palace fan base. Well, they don't represent the Palace fan base at all. I think it's a very much a space where you just hear a very loud minority. I just think people need to be kind to each other. I did tweet on it last night. I don't think age is a stick to bat anyone with, beat anyone with, whether that's beating me because I'm a younger journalist or lots of tweets I saw last night scrolling through Twitter before I went to bed, before deleting the app, of just fans coming at younger fans for being frustrated with the result because they weren't there during the 70s when things were tough. Things are tough now, whether you're in the Premier League or the second division, it doesn't really matter. If things aren't going well, people have a right to feel how they want to feel about football. Yes, people can disagree with opinions. Yes, you can contest someone's opinions. But it just needs to stop being made overly personal. I think it's quite petty. People are accusing people of being childish for getting upset with it, when actually the people who are going on the attack all the time are the childish ones. So I'd just like to see people being a bit nicer to each other, really.
Yeah, I'll echo that. I mean, all of us that have even some sort of a platform on there have been through what you're going through. And it is important to remember that it doesn't reflect the majority of the good people that support this club. And to your credit, who cares how old you are, how young you are, you're hungry, you're pushing yourself, and I think you have a lot to be proud of, my man. And on that note, I'd like to thank you for coming in and joining us yet again as one of our regular guests. We're always appreciative to have you and your insights on here. So I'll give you the floor if you want to give any quick sign off or one last
Yeah, no,
final
thank you
comment
very
for you.
much for having me. No plugs, just the whole philosophical moment at the end.
Nothing wrong with that. And for me, I again want to appreciate you guys for coming up and listening. As always, you can find us on socials. Find us at thepalaceway.com for original articles talking about the academy, talking about tactics, talking about the Women's League, possibly now that Bobby's been bringing that up. So, go ahead and look that up if that's what you're into, or if you're into Instagram, Twitter, any of the like. Give us a follow, give us a like, give us a comment on wherever you find this podcast, even if it's one star. Let's hope it's not, but any feedback is good for us to know what we need to do better and what you're liking, we should do more of. Till next time, out the palace.